verse 1 of chapter 2. Now, we've already seen in chapter 1 where these Israelites who've been in bondage for 70 years, some of them, those who were carried away on the last carrying away had been there for 50 years. So people had been in captivity. A few years before their release, they had heard that Persia had, that Babylon had fallen, that there was a new world power, and they were very hopeful that that might mean something positive for them. And then just not long after that, sure enough, Cyrus, king of Persia, issued an edict freeing the Jews to go back to their homeland, all who wanted to. And he charged them with building the temple. See, Isaiah the prophet, some 150 years at least prior to this, had prophesied, had even called him by name, that a man named Cyrus would let the people go. Jeremiah had prophesied concerning the 70 years of captivity and so forth and so on. And so here they were now, actually being allowed to go back. And he not only allows them to go back, but he tells them that I want you to build the temple. I'm going to help pay for things. And so they return. So in chapter 2 and verse 1, We're talking about the people now that are going back to Jerusalem. Now these were the people of the province who came up out of the captivity of those exiles whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried captive to Babylon. They returned to Jerusalem and Judah. Now get this, each to his own town. They came with Zerubbabel, Jeshua, Nehemiah, Sariah, Rehaliah, Mordecai, Bilshan, Mispar, Bigva, Rehum, Baana. The number of the men of the people of Israel, and then beginning in verse 3, through most of the rest of the chapter, he lists by family, mostly by family, sometimes by descendants, and sometimes even by location, by towns from which their descendants had come. And so we saw that, you remember when we were studying the Pentateuch, sometimes in a list like this, instead of names, there would be locations. And that stood for people, but it stood for people who were associated with that location. So that's kind of how this list is. He lists them by families, by descendants, by location. And we'll talk just a little bit more about that in a minute. What he's doing here, he's establishing continuity, the continuity of the nation of God's chosen people. He's linking these people who have returned to Jerusalem to those people who had lived in the homeland prior to the destruction and captivity. And it's also implying that they were still, even though they were small in number, even though they were but a remnant, it's implying that they were still God's chosen people, and that God would continue to be with them and bless them even through the intertestament period of some 400 years. And why would he do that? All the way down to the time of the what? Of the coming of the Messiah. To the coming of the Messiah. And so, this is a list of those who returned. Now, the return from exile was not an all-at-once experience. Well, for example, here in the book of Ezra, the first one to return was Zerubbabel, and these people, and the number of them that we're going to discuss in just a minute, pretty big number. And then later, some 80 years later, beginning in chapter 7 of the book of Ezra, Ezra himself, scribe and priest, would return to Jerusalem. And then sometime after him, not too long after, but sometime after he returned, Nehemiah returned. And it's very likely that over this entire period, some might have trickled in from time to time. And so it was not an all or all at once experience, but the largest group to return was the one that we are studying about here at this time. Now, it's interesting. Look at verse 2. They came with Zerubbabel, not Sheshbazzar. You remember in chapter 1, we read about an individual named Sheshbazzar. He was the one to whom the treasurer of Cyrus had turned over those all of the vessels that Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple when he captured and destroyed the city. He had taken them back to Babylon, had put them in one of his house of one of his gods, and they had been there all of this time. And so now a new nation and a new king, and he not only said, I want you to go back, but here are the vessels that Nebuchadnezzar, and he gave them to someone named Sheshbazzar. Well, this is not Sheshbazzar, Sheshbazzar, but it's Zerubbabel. But it's really the same person. They're the same person. One is the Persian name for him. Zerubbabel is his Hebrew name. And we know this for a number of reasons. For one thing, in the fifth chapter of Ezra, we will read again that Sheshbazzar was the one who laid the foundations. But earlier in that same chapter, in chapter 5 and verse 2, also in chapter 3 and verse 8, which I hope we get to this morning, we're told that Zerubbabel was the one who laid the foundations. So it's almost universally accepted that the two are the same. And it stands to reason. A Hebrew having also a Persian name is certainly in keeping with what we know about that period. Remember the Daniel and his friends who were carried away into Babylonian captivity? They were what? Given what? New names. So it's not unlikely, you see. Not only that, it's altogether possible, and I think even likely, that this person, Zerubbabel, or Sheshbazzar, had a position of some sort. Maybe in the Babylonian court before they were destroyed, before they fell, or maybe even in the Persian court. Because stop and think about it. Cyrus is not going to turn 50 plus thousand people loose on a mission like he gives them, turn it over to someone that he doesn't know about and have the confidence in as being able to do that, you see. So they're the same people, very likely, and he's the one that is mentioned here. Now let's go down to verse 61 of this same chapter. All right. Verse 61. Also, the sons of the priests, the sons of Habiah, the sons of Hakkath, and the sons of Barzillai, who had taken a wife from the daughters of Barzillai, the Gileadite, and was called by their name, these sought their registration among those enrolled in the genealogies, but they were not found there, and so they were excluded from the priesthood as unclean. Now notice verse 63. And the governor, this would be Zerubbabel, told them that they were not to partake of the most holy food until there should be a priest to consult Urim and Thummim. Now, what's this all about? First of all, what does it mean when Zerubbabel told them that they were not to partake of the holy food? Anybody have a guess? Absolutely. Janice says the priests were not only allowed, but that was part of the way they were sustained, some of the food from some of the sacrifices that were offered. And so what he's just simply saying to them is, you can't be priest, you can't serve in the temple as though you were a Levite, because we don't know about your genealogy. They were not able, that either lost their evidence or were not in some way able to verify the fact that they were indeed. And so he said, I want you to wait until, notice this expression, until there should be a priest to consult Urim. And you remember back in Exodus when they were talking, when we read about the attire of the priests. They were to have this thing, I think at times it was called an ephod, maybe. But it was a kind of, not an apron, but kind of a garment that went on top of garment, your garments. And it had a back and a front, and the two pieces were joined at the shoulders, and it describes how they were joined. And they were also joined down here at the waist. And on the front of it, it was a kind of a pouch. And the names of the 12 tribes were there engraved on various kinds of stone. But in that pouch, they were told to put the Urim and the Thummim. Now, not a lot is said about it, not a lot is known about it, but it was apparently two kinds of rocks, maybe two different colored rocks or two different pieces of something or other. But something that was kept in that pouch. And the priest, whenever they wanted to consult and know what God's will was, it was kind of like what happened in Acts 1 when they were choosing someone to replace Judas. Casting lots. It's kind of like casting lots. And God would make known unto them His will in that case through the casting of lots. That's kind of what this was. Again, we don't know exactly how it worked, but it was something along that line. But apparently, Zerubbabel believes that just as before the destruction, the priests were able to utilize this Urim and Thummim to determine God's will, he was expecting that after the temple was built, he would be able to do that again and would be able to use that means to determine whether or not these people were really who they thought they were. Unfortunately, he was disappointed in that expectation, because they had forfeited the right of Urim and Thummim by their disbelief, by those actions which had caused them to be destroyed and taken away into captivity. We'll say a little bit more about that as we go along. Okay, now let's look at verse 64. The whole assembly together was, that is, numbered 42,360. Now, if you've been reading ahead of me, and if you read this chapter carefully, you already know that those numbers that are given in this chapter don't add up to 42,360. In fact, a similar list is found in the book of Nehemiah, chapter 7. Nehemiah also refers back to the time when these people came, and he gives the list, and his list differs from the one here. In fact, in verse 2, when I read to you a moment ago, it mentions Zerubbabel and Joshua the priest, and nine other people for a total of 11. Nehemiah's list, in addition to Zerubbabel and Joshua, lists 10 other people for a total of 12. And his numbers and those names differ just slightly. and his numbers. By the way, Ezra's numbers add up to 29,818. And Nehemiah's numbers add up to 31,089. And there's still another list in the book called Esdras, which is an apocryphal book that is found in the, for example, in the, what is the, Cecil, what is the Egyptian, the Greek translation of the Old Testament? The Greek translation, Septuagint version. This book Esdras is found in that and some other translations. But anyway, it has a list too. Now, apocryphal, not in the canon, not in the biblical canon, and the number in that one adds up to 33,900. But interestingly, though they each differ in some small way, all three of them agree on the total. All three of them agree on the total that is listed here. They all list as the total 42,360. So we don't know exactly how to explain. The people of that day would have understood it. And there may be some numbers, if you've read much from the Old Testament and comments about it, numbers were oftentimes, you know, copied wrong or something. But anyway, pretty good. Oh, and then he says this, there were 42,360 besides their male and female servants, of whom there were 7,337, and they had 200 male and female singers. But even if you add these two groups to the 42,000, it'd still be slightly under 50,000. By the way, in the book of Esdras, the apocryphal book, the comment is made that those who were 12 and under were not counted, or those under 12 were not counted. We don't have any way of knowing whether that's the case or not. If it is the case, then the number would be much more than 50,000. But in any case, 50,000 is a lot of people to go traipsing across the land. That's my point. You think about a caravan of 50. Now, it wasn't unheard of in those days. I understand that historians would not be surprised by this, because you can read from history of other peoples who made similar trips with far more than 50. But it's not a small job to get 50,000 people. Now think about it now. Families, children, running here and there and everywhere. And the distance we're talking about, if they came across the Arabian Desert in more of a kind of a, as the bird flies, as we say, straight, you know, it would have been 800 miles. But most of the time, even armies wouldn't come that way. They would go west for a while, and then over around Mount Hebron and Damascus. They would cut down just east of Tyre and Sidon and come. The armies of Assyria, for example, and Babylon, that's the route they took most of that. It's a safer, easier journey, but a little bit longer. It'd be about 1,000 miles. But whether 800 miles across the desert or 1,000 miles, that's a long way for a lot of people. Let's keep reading here. Their camels were 435. Their donkeys were 6,020. Well, I missed some. Their verse 66, their horses were 736, their mules were 245, their camels were 435, and their donkeys were 6,720. Now, you may wonder, why would something like this be recorded? Well, I'm sure God had His purpose for it and reason for it. And let's remember now, this is the God who numbers even the hairs on your head. So He knows all the details about, and it has historical value as well. That's one thing we can know. It tells us something about, these were for the most part poor people. Look, on average they had one donkey for every six people. They had one horse for every 60 people. They had one camel for every 100 people. And they had one mule for every 175 people. So the donkey was still the beast of burden. It was the main thing that the common people used in their conveyance of things. And the horse was rarely owned or used by the common people. And then the camel and the mule was even rarer than that. But the donkey was still the beast of burden. Now you think about 50,000 people. So this would mean if there was on average of one for every six people, that's telling us that basically each family unit had its own donkey. So you've got 1,000 miles to travel. You're going to be traveling, you know, in all kinds of weather, and you, everything you own that you can, you carry with you. And you could just imagine how difficult that may have been. So that's what we're talking about here. And also, this will come into play a little later. It also goes on to tell us in verse 69, according to their ability, they gave to the treasury of the work 61,000 derricks of gold and 5,000 minas of silver and 100 priests' garments. The derrick, this again, is where the archaeologists have helped us. The critics used to say that this is just another example of the inaccuracy of Scripture because the derrick was not used this early in history. But as you can think already just by my mentioning that, archaeologists have turned over the shovel and they have proven that to be incorrect. They were indeed the Persians in use, even among the Persians of the very time we're talking about here. Okay, any question or comment before we move on to chapter 3? Yes. Good point. Good point. You remember God had promised Abraham that all the nations through your seed, through your descendant, the nations of the earth would be blessed. And so they had to keep these records very carefully for one thing, to make sure this is showing that God's word is true. And so even though it had been a lot of years since that, many, many, many years since God had made that promise to Abraham, and the nation had been destroyed and they'd been in captivity, these people still had their records of their, you know, they could prove that that we're the descendants of Abraham, we're those of whom the promise was made, and also descendants of David, because he, a covenant was made with him too, that one of his seed would. So that was all. Now, admittedly, the Jews carried that too far at one point, didn't they? It was important because it was necessary to show that God's promise was fulfilled, but they got to the point that they would say, what? We are Abraham's seed. You remember? So they carried it too far. And Jesus said that they were told that God's able of these stones to raise up people. Okay. Any other questions? Yes. Zerubbabel is listed in the lineage of Jesus.
It's interesting that a lot of times you think about the
stuff. That's right. Absolutely. That's exactly right. Yes. Well, you remember a similar thing happened when they left Egypt. The people there gave them things. And remember now, the Jews down through the centuries have been good at accumulating wealth and so forth. And so, yes. So, yeah. Yeah. Some of it came from the people because remember the edict was, said, we're going to let you go. And then he addressed the people who were their neighbors, those who would not be going, said, I want you to give to them, you know. And then he did so himself as an example. You know, he gave. And then they gave. So, and there's a discussion, does this mean only the Jews who were their neighbors or does it mean the, I think it means both. I think it could very well mean both, and so there could be a lot of reasons why people do it. Some you might say some would give because they're glad to get rid of them. Others would give because they'd become friendly toward each other. But for whatever reason, they didn't leave empty-handed, did it? Like you said, when we just read, when they got there, they had stuff to give toward the building of the temple. Any other questions or comments?
In connection with the difficulty of the journey that they had to make, I wonder if God did not care for them in a special way, similar to what he did in the wilderness one.
That's a good point. You would think so, wouldn't you? Doug is just raising the question that you would wonder if God did not care for them, because that was a treacherous journey. In a lot of ways, and though we're not told specifics about it, but you get the, that's a good. Is someone back here? Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's the reason I said it boggles the mind, really, when you think about 50,000 people traveling in caravan together and all that entails. It's just, and how long did it take? Well, we don't know for sure. It doesn't say about them. Now in the seventh chapter, when we read about Ezra himself coming to Jerusalem, we're told that he left on the first day of the first month, that's their month, not ours, first day of the first month, and arrived on the first day of the fifth. So it took him 4 months. We don't know which way he went. He came, but it took him 4 months for the journey. So I would assume, we're going to talk about that just a minute in the chapter we're fixing to start, but we don't know, but they probably left in a similar time, maybe the first or second month, and at least, I would think at least took 4 months, you know, for that many people. But we're going to read in chapter 3 that in the seventh month, they assemble and start sacrifices and that sort of thing. So let's just say they left in the first month as Ezra did, and even if they made it in 4 months, then that means they got there at the beginning of the fifth month. So the fifth and sixth month they spent in their towns from which they had come. You know, just think about it. They're going back. They hadn't been there. You know, they got to go back and see if, you know, is the old home place there? Can I live there now? They got to make arrangements for their personal living and so forth. And so they had, at most, the way I figure it, they had a couple of months before the seventh month, about which we're about to read in chapter 3. Any other questions or comments? Or yes.
A number of years ago, it was discovered by archaeologists using texts that a number of the Jewish men in captivity
Pharisees saying that archaeologists have proven that some of these people rose to high positions in these governments. Well, think back at Joseph. What happened to him in Egypt? And then Daniel in Babylon. And so it's not a big leap at all for us to think that Zerubbabel had some kind of responsibility and some kind of position that led the Cyrus to believe that this is the man who could do that. Yes. Yeah. Or more. Yeah. Yeah, okay. Any further comments or questions? Okay, chapter 3. Let's read the first 5 verses and then we'll talk about them. When the 7th month came. Well, let me make a comment before we go any further. 7th month. The 7th month was the most sacred month in the Jewish calendar. First of all, there was the sacrifices of the with reference to the new moon that came around every month. Secondly, there was a special called a solemn fast that was inaugurated for the seventh, the first day of the 7th month. A solemn fast. This was in addition to the new moon sacrifice and all. And it was characterized by the blowing of trumpets and all the people coming together, a day of convocation, I believe is what they would call it, and so forth. And then those two things at the beginning of the month, on the 10th day of the 7th month, what was it? Day of Atonement. Day of Atonement. Now, interestingly, nothing is said about the Day of Atonement. I'm of the opinion that they didn't observe it because the temple had not yet been built. And part of the things required for the Day of Atonement involved the high priest going into the Holy of Holies and so forth. So, but whether that's true or not, it's not mentioned. But the Day of Atonement was a part. And then on the 15th day of the 7th month, what began? The Feast of Tabernacles, which was the third and last of the 3 great feasts, Passover, Pentecost, and Tabernacles, began on the 15th, lasted 7 days until the 22nd. So this gives you an idea of why it was such a sacred month. And so it's not... And so the exile, and so when the 7th month came and the children of of Israel were in the towns, remember we were told in verse 1 of chapter 2 that when they came back, they first went to their own towns. When the 7th month came and the children of Israel were in the towns, the people gathered as one man to Jerusalem. Then arose Jeshua, the son of Josadak, with his fellow priest, and Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, with his kinsmen, and they built the altar of the God of Israel to offer burnt offerings on it, as is written in the law of Moses, the man of God. And they set the altar in its place, for fear was on them because of the peoples of the land. And they offered burnt offerings on it to the Lord, burnt offerings morning and evening. And they kept the Feast of Booths, Feast of Tabernacles, Feast of Ingatherings, as it is written, and offered the daily burnt offerings by number according to the rule as each day required. And after that, the regular burnt offerings, the offerings at the new moon and at all the appointed feasts of the Lord, and the offerings of everyone who made a freewill offering to God. And so, at first, as we've already said, the people, when they arrived in Judah, they went each to his own town. And then when the 7th month was come, the people gathered themselves together as one man to observe these feasts. But first of all, the altar had to be built. Now, I'm of the opinion, and though it says in verse 2 that they built it on the... In other words, it says, some commentators are of the opinion that they came together on the first day of the seventh month and they built the altar that day and started... But verse 6 seems to suggest otherwise. Verse 6 says, from the first day of the seventh month, they began to offer burnt offerings to the Lord. So it seems to me that the altar had already been put together and had been finished prior to the first day, so that when they came together, and that could very well be the reason for their coming together. The word has gone out that the altar was ready and they wanted to come. And everybody would have been aware of the significance of the seventh month. So they come together as one month. That's the way it seems to me like it would be. And it says that they offered the daily burnt offerings, morning and evening. This is that offering that went on 24/7, 365, right? Every day of the year, the morning offering and the evening offering. So they started that, and then it says in the next verse that they kept the Feast of Booths and offered the daily burnt offerings by number according to the rule. In other words, 7 days for the feast. And the law specified just what offering should be made each of those 7 days. So that's what he's saying here, that they not only just observed it in a general sort of way, but they were careful. They were careful to do it as the Lord had commanded that they do it. Notice this. Here it is, verse 3. They set the altar in its place. What this is telling us, I think, is that when they got there and they began to examine the temple area where all of the destruction had taken place, they were able to ascertain where the altar had been, exactly where it is. That's not hard to understand. Pharisees and them, they dig up foundations that are thousands of years old. They can pretty well determine what was there and where its boundaries were. So they could see where the... And so they were careful. They set the altar in its place. This is telling me, and something else we're going to read a little bit later on that we'll talk about next week. This tells me that they were... These people who returned from captivity were being careful to do everything according to what was right, and so they built the altar. Now it didn't. I'm sure it didn't resemble the altar that had been torn down. In fact, some commentators suggested it was built from just field stones. Or of course, there were lots of stones laying about in Jerusalem from the destruction of all those walls and buildings and such like. But they were probably utilizing older stones and putting things together as best they could, because it was kind of a makeshift type thing, perhaps. But they were trying to do things as best they could. Jeshua is mentioned first in this regard, whereas most of the time it's Zerubbabel and then Jeshua. But remember, with regard to the temple itself, the priest had the first responsibility. And so here, and by the way, Ezra, nowhere in the book of Ezra is he referred to as chief priest. Now the indication, I think chapter 3 implies in several verses that he was, but it never says that he was chief. But both Haggai the prophet and Zechariah the prophet, both of them specifically say that he was the high priest. And then after that first day, they reestablished, they started observing from then on all of the various feasts. First of all, the continuing, the daily morning and evening sacrifice started on the first day, and they kept it up from then on. And then it mentions the new moon specifically. So every month following, they would offer the sacrifices associated with that. And then it mentions, the new moon and all the appointed feasts of the Lord. That would certainly include Passover, Pentecost, and Tabernacle, and it might include some others as well. And so from the first day, verse 6, of the seventh month, they began to offer burnt offerings to the Lord. But the foundation of the temple of the Lord was not yet laid. So this is a good place for us to stop. So they've reestablished all of these sacrifices. They've made plans to do it. You got everything set in order. The altar now is in place so that they can do that. But they still don't have a temple, not even a foundation for a temple. And so they set about to do that. And that's what we'll be reading about next week. First of all, they collect the materials, make plans for building and so forth and so on. All right. All right. We'll continue on next week with the rest of chapter 3 and chapter 4.